everybody, Dana here, and today Chelsea and I are super excited to welcome Jonathan Merritt to the Collective Table podcast. If you do not know Jonathan Merritt, let me just tell you, he is an award-winning columnist, commentator on politics, spirituality, and culture, where faith and culture intersect. He's a critically acclaimed author. He's got several books out there. He contributes to The Week and has been featured on prominent national outlets, including the New York Times, USA Today, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, and CNN. But today we're going to talk about his new book, a children's book, his first children's book called My Gunkle and Me. Chelsea and I are just really excited for you to hear this conversation. I don't want to take up too much time, but do want to let you know to check Jonathan Merritt out. If you are unfamiliar, or even if you are familiar, you can follow him on Instagram. That is his social media of choice. Or you can go to jonathanmerritt.com to get more information. Now enjoy the episode.
Welcome, Collective Table listeners. We are so excited for today's episode. It's a little bit different of an episode today because today we are talking about a children's book, but a much needed children's book. And we're so excited to welcome to the podcast Jonathan Merritt. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us. We're excited to dive in.
Oh my gosh. Thank you guys for having me on. It's a pleasure.
So you've written books before, you have a long resume of articles and all this, but you kind of took a departure with this children's book. What was that impetus of that? Like, why children's book? Why now?
Well, you know, if I were a non-Christian walking around New York, I would say this was the universe. Maybe some folks in Southern California who would use that language as well. Being a Christian, I would say this was sort of a God thing. It is not something that made a lot of sense. It wasn't like a calculated career move. I was working with some people and helping them with their children's books, putting them together and editing them and refining them. And I was like, I kind of love doing this. And so I said to a really good friend of mine who lives in the community where I live, my friend Shauna, I said, I think I want to write a children's book. And she was like, well, what would you write it about? And I said, I don't know. And she said, well, why don't you write about being a gunkle? And, you know, it was like a light bulb went off. And I've been telling writers who I coach over the years that the stories you should be telling are the stories you're living. And yet it sort of evaded me that this is exactly what I should be doing, because I had been living this incredible, healing, transformative story, living in community embedded with these families here in New York. And yet I was trying to like come up, you know, with some sort of fanciful, fantastical tale. And I decided then, well, I'll just pull from the stories that I've been living to create this really fun adventure. And that's what I did.
So you just used the word gunkle.
Yes.
Tell us, this is the title of the book, My Gunkle and Me. What's a gunkle?
A gunkle is two words squeezed together, gay and uncle. And so what I'm intending to do or hoping to do with this character is to illustrate that a gunkle is different than just a regular, ordinary uncle, that because of the life experiences that have shaped these family members, that they're special and the gifts they have to give are special. And so the story doesn't explain what a gunkle is, right? There's no partner or explanation of it. And so parents are really empowered to have that conversation with their kids in the way that they feel comfortable having that conversation. But it's a story about a child who lives in a world where gunkles exist, which is a world that a lot of kids these days live in.
Did you come up with the word? Like, how did it manifest in your life? Was it your word, or was it one of your niece, nephews who came up with it? And you're like, oh my gosh, that's so awesome.
You know, it's a word that I have heard over many years. Like people have said, as they've had kids, they'll sort of claim that word. There's actually a novel that came out a few years ago by a guy named Stephen Rowley called The Gunkle. And I think he has another book by the sort of a sequel coming out. And so, you know, you can find like little tchotchkes online and things that sort of display this idea of being a gunkle. And so I think it's something that I've heard, but I thought like, how do I have this character and communicate from the jump, from the cover, you know, who this character is and the role that he plays in this child's life? What I'm really hoping for is that people who are gunkles will go, oh yeah, yeah, this book is for me. This is something I can read with my nephews and nieces and my stepkids or godkids or whatever. And so that's what I'm really hoping. And then I think on the other side of that, because it is this like fun, adventuresome story of this kid, Henry Higgleston, and his fabulous gunkle, that also just parents who value diverse storytelling and diverse characters and inclusive stories, that they'll also get this book and they'll use it in their families as well.
We'll get into like a little bit of your story in a second, but like it's not overtly Christian or religious or spiritual or anything like that, but it has these undertones with acceptance and love and validating the child's experience that really, that's how we view God, right? Like that's what God, the gunkle is the God figure in that, right? Like you're loved just as you are, you're accepted just as you are. How does your faith kind of play into that? Because some of our listeners know, you know, I mean, hopefully all of our listeners know that we're a progressive Christian platform. So we're open to all different walks of life, but there are sects and pockets of Christianity that aren't. So how does that kind of like come together for you in this writing?
Well, you know, I grew up very conservative. My dad was the president of the Southern Baptist Convention. You know, he was a televangelist and described himself sort of proudly as to the right of Ronald Reagan, right? So I don't know how you can get more conservative than that, you know, without falling off the edge of the stage. But, you know, that was the context that sort of formed me and shaped me. And it was the context I was living in when I began to come out, you know, more than a decade ago. For me, there were kind of two paths once I came out, and this is the choice that a lot of people feel that they're given, right? They can either embrace who they are and walk away from their faith, or they can walk away from who they are and embrace their faith. Those are both really bad choices, but we're lucky because they're not the only choices. That there's a third choice, and it's not always a choice that is given to kids in conservative or fundamentalist Christian households, which is God created you as you are, and God loves you as you are, and that you don't have to become what somebody else wants you to become in order to be loved by God. And so you don't live in a reality where you have to choose between who you are and your faith in God. And so it was kind of out of that experience that I think came this radical acceptance of both my faith and my identity, and learning that when those things got to coexist in the same space, they would kind of inform each other and enhance each other. I actually became more in love with my faith and more sure and proud of who I was when both of those realities were allowed to coexist alongside each other. And you know, there are in this book, there are kind of some faith elements. You know, there's the very front flap of the book says a line from the book, "You can move like a dancer or sing like a star. You can be who God made you, whatever you are." You know, that is something so deeply rooted in what it means to be a person of faith, and for me, what it means to be a Christian. And then there's obviously in the book, there's this sort of iconic scene where the gunkle and Henry go to church together. And in fact, I can read it to you because I have an early copy of the book with me. But you know, they go to church together, and it says, "At church the next morning, my gunkle sings loudly. He prays and gives thanks, and he does it devoutly. Bright colored outfit makes two women stare. When we pass, they both snicker, but he doesn't care." And I wanted to show two things about that. One, that a person who has a queer identity can also be an incredibly devout person of deep faith. And so I thought that was really important to showcase in this book. And then I also wanted to highlight that for people who are like me, that sometimes when you walk into religious spaces, they're spaces of conformity and coercion, where people misunderstand who we are or refuse to accept who we are until we become who they want us to be. And I think the gunkle sort of modeling both what it meant to enter into that space and be fully who he was, and also to sort of shake off the expectations of others and embrace who he was at his core so that Henry could sort of see that model. It's the kind of thing I hope will give these little readers courage to be who they are too.
Was it a journey for you to take those two identities and realize that they can coexist and they can coexist in a beautiful, harmonious way? There doesn't have to be one or the other. Is it a process? Was it a process for you?
It was an incredible process. And the reason is because, you know, all of us, and maybe this is one of the reasons why I even wrote this book to begin with, is that I've long understood that the future is largely a function of the types of stories we choose to tell our children. Because the stories that we tell our children, you know, it's like if you lived in the 80s, and I barely did, but I did. You know, we have these little cassette tapes, and sometimes you just pop them in when they're in the car, and you know, you're not able to kind of skip tracks. So they would just play in the background. And we had our favorite cassette tapes and they would play. And it would be like, you know, without even paying attention to them, I would come to kind of memorize the lyrics and they would become imprinted on me in some way. This happens with the stories we tell our children, and not just the stories that we tell them in children's books, but the stories we tell them about God and the stories that we tell them with our lives as parents. And so I had this soundtrack that was playing, and it was a soundtrack that said, God will not love you if this is who you are. It was a soundtrack that said, you have to change if you want to be accepted by God and accepted in a spiritual or religious community. And so it's like, you know, I had to learn, like, how do I get this thing to stop? What is the button that I have to push? How do I eject this thing? And then you first have to realize, like, it's safe to do that. That when you eject that tape, you're not sort of like punching your ticket to hell. You're actually liberating yourself into the radical love of God. And that is a long, long process, because first you have to find the courage to hit the eject button. Then you have to figure out how to do it. Then once you pull that tape out, you have to find a better tape to insert in there. And then what happens is you're like riding down the road, and somehow that old tape keeps finding its way back in there. And so you have to keep doing it. And I found this to be so true that I'll have a conversation with someone, and I'll have started that conversation thinking, I've processed this, I've shaken this off. And then I'll end up and I'll have, you know, the tears will be running down my cheeks, and I'll go, I guess I have more processing to do. I remember when I opened the box and I pulled out my Gunkle and Me for the first time, and it was like this icon of self-acceptance. And I was trying to film, you know, a cool unboxing video for Instagram. And I just started just bawling. And it was such a release. It's such a sort of a road sign, a marker, a milestone of the journey that I've taken that's now stretched over 10 years. And I think that when we give our children really bad stories, it offers them a lifetime of work, unfortunately.
Yeah, I have two small children, 4 and 6, and I keep trying to, every time I talk about God or the world or, you know, anything really, it's like, how do I teach them in ways that they're not going to have to unlearn all of this later? Like the way that a lot of us have had to do, especially around theology. What I love about the book too is whether my kids are gay or straight or whatever they choose to be, it's not just about that. It's about, like you're saying, it wasn't about, oh, I am your gay uncle and this is my partner. It was more acceptance. And when you're talking, Jonathan, it's like alignment with who God created me to be, alignment with where I feel safe, all of the things that God created us to be, like that we are able to step into them, that we're able to be accepted, that we're able to accept other people for who God created them to be. It's like the whole story of acceptance ourselves and other people. So it's really like the core message of, I mean, even as an adult reading, it's like, oh yeah, I still have stuff I have to accept about myself, right? That didn't have the tape playing the way that you did necessarily. Everybody has their own tapes that they have to kind of push, eject, and find a new tape for.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And even in this story, I mean, you know, it starts out with Henry not being accepted at school. And, you know, he wears this kind of weird T-Rex hoodie that's sort of odd. And, you know, when other kids are out playing sports, he's digging for worms. He likes doing math homework. Who likes doing math homework, right? So he's odd in all these ways. it's not the ways that the gunkle is odd, right? It's not like this kid's wrestling with his sexuality. He's a young kid who's wrestling with like the kind of things that a lot of young kids are wrestling with in school. And he's living in a place, which is where many kids live, where differences are not gifts to be embraced. They're liabilities. They're things that threaten your sense of belonging and your sense even maybe of safety. You know, he's seeing the gunkle embrace parts of himself or having embraced parts of himself that are different than what Henry is dealing with, but then deriving from that model, the inspiration that's required to embrace his own differences as being special. I think that's something that's kind of magical in the book, is that you can see that whatever it is, that it's not a book about a certain way of being different. It's about differences themselves, and that those differences are actually what make you you and not someone else.
So I have teenagers, right? So I've been through kind of the young phase, and I'm like, wow, I see this book. I see following Henry, the character, all because that is a huge battle for my teenagers right now, is to not want to conform, because they want to conform. Even if they don't want to conform, they want to conform. And I'm sure there's psychology behind all of it. And so I'm like, wow, are we going to follow this character all the way through his life to really see how it changes and how it gets, you know, complex and complicated. But yeah, I mean, it definitely resonates even with me having teenagers.
Yeah, and it is a conversation that should begin in childhood. But it's a conversation, you know, I always say I wrote this book for kids of all ages, because it's a conversation that continues when we're adults. You know, you ask any soccer mom in the suburbs, or, you know, dad working on Wall Street, and they want to dress and act like everyone around them. And the pressure to conform to our environments, which requires denying our true selves, denying what we know to be true about us in the place deep down inside us where we know things, that temptation is not something that just afflicts children. But if children can develop the muscle memory for embracing their uniqueness, then that muscle memory can kind of function later on in life. So it's in those formative stages where we have to, I think, give children the tools to combat the things that they will experience as soccer moms working on Wall Street, or by the way, or moms working on Wall Street, or soccer dads. So I think it's important that we move upstream and teach kids that, rather than trying to convince them that once they're already adults and they're already sort of given into conformity and they have, you know, 15 or 20 years practice being like everyone else.
I'm curious, you know, at a time right now where we're seeing a lot of energy and noise on banning books. Uh-huh. I love that this book is coming out. I mean, I think this is amazing. Like, what a great time. And what a need that we have for it. What are your thoughts on, like, did you think about that? Or just knowing like that we have a need, that these types of books, they need to exist right now, and they need to be in the hands of families, young children.
Well, this is sort of the hard thing, because we know that we need stories like this. We also live in a moment where stories like this are increasingly seen as a threat to certain kinds of people. People are trying to sort of destroy and obliterate these kinds of stories. And, you know, when I wrote this, and this is maybe my own like naivete, but it didn't occur to me that I was going to maybe step into something like this. It never really crossed my mind. I just thought, and this is part of one of the downsides of living in New York City, maybe, because New York City, I mean, there are people here who vote for Donald Trump and identify as pro-life and go to conservative evangelical churches. But those people are used to coexisting alongside people who are not like them. And so there's this sort of expectation that we can sort of make space for divergent beliefs and divergent stories. And so I forget sometimes living here that there are people in other places who feel very threatened by stories that are not like their stories, or that conflict with the stories that they want told. When I announced that this book was coming out, I'd announced it like on all these social media platforms. And I went to bed and I woke up in the morning and I had, you know, some texts from people saying like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. What happened on Twitter? And I was like, what happened on Twitter? You know, I don't really go on there much anymore, but I'd posted this book announcement on there. And I went on and some, you know, conservative, like right wing folks had posted about it and it had just gone viral. I've had people attack me as a columnist on Twitter before. I've never had death threats. I've never had people say, you know, they wanted to burn me alive or that they hoped God would take my life this very day. That was sort of like really jarring to me. So I've never had, and you know, where I live, it's sort of public knowledge where I live. I posted about where I live. I was like, you know, people are crazy. I have a very good friend who works for GLAAD. He's comms director at GLAAD. And I was like, sent this to him. And I was like, what do I do? Yeah. And he's like, you know, I deleted the post. He said, you have to make your Twitter account private. This is not a safe space anymore. What I realized was, is that this stories have become a battleground for the culture wars. And so it's not like somebody saying, I don't like your story, so I won't buy your story, right? Nobody's required to buy this book if they don't like it. But now they're saying, I don't like your story, so your story shouldn't exist. And the obliteration of stories is one of the key markers that we're moving into a very dark time.
Yeah, I agree. Oh, that is awful. This is a real life example right here. You hear this in the news, and then you talk to somebody and you're like, okay, this is real.
It's kind of similar to like Dane had just Googled like progressive Christianity a couple of days ago. And like, you know, the first three articles maybe are like, okay, a little bit close to it. But then the rest are just like demonizing people and progressive Christianity and lying about it, not really even saying what it is. And just the fear that comes with it. It's so overwhelming. And it's, I think when you take a step back, you realize, you know, you're afraid of your life, the way you've lived your life, whatever it's threatening to you. But it's like, it impedes the people who need it, right? Like, you know, some people who don't have access to a church space that says you're loved as you are, or access to books that can kind of give a different perspective on life. It's like the people that actually need it don't have even access to it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Which I guess is good that we're living in like the Zoom online. Hopefully people can find what they need in that kind of capacity. But
well, yeah. And social media, I mean, like there's clearly is drawbacks to social media, but a benefit is your voice gets out there.
Yeah. And you know, we live in a moment though, that when you go looking for something, there is an algorithm, someone or someone's or someone's creation of something that determines what you see when you go looking for something. And so that's a downside. You know, there's been a lot of conversation lately about the kind of search results that are prioritized on certain platforms and which ones are not, and how do you decide what is quote unquote dangerous or not. And that can be kind of a scary place, is if enough people say that what you and I believe is dangerous, and those people are in the right positions with the right companies, they can choose to make it so that the content that we put out, when people go looking for that exact content, can't find it. And so there are these other powers and principalities that exist that are unseen, that are shaping the world that we live in.
So true.
As a straight person, like I didn't realize that until I had a young adult queer group that used to meet when I was part of a church, and Instagram would regularly shut down our account. And I'm like horrified by this, right? Like I was like, what is going on? And then I told the group and they're like, oh, that happens all the time. Like I didn't even know that was a thing that could happen unless you were like actually threatening. And they were just like, oh, that happens to our accounts all the time. They just get shut down and like erased because somebody somewhere doesn't like what you're saying. And so it was the first time I was living in a bubble of like, oh, everybody just works the same way and everybody's like all that white privilege type of thing, but straight privilege, you know? So it was kind of eye-opening for me that it's like, oh yeah, there's a lot of control that's outside of, I put a hashtag, why is no one finding me, you know, type of stuff.
Yes, exactly. And on the opposite side, when people are actually threatening, and of course, there's lots of stories on this too, right? When they're actually threatening, nothing happens. So there's like this policing of certain ideas. And then when there's actual risk of like bodily harm, like one thing is not like the other, you can't get anyone to do anything about it. And so that has created, I think, some of this collective frustration when it comes to accessing this type of stuff just in our everyday lives on social media and the internet.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Unfortunately, hopefully the world will, I can only have hope. I'm trying to have hope. And have hope for the church. I would have hope for the church because, I should not say much about the church. I'm going to ask you a question about the church because I don't go to church anymore. I totally stopped going to church. Doesn't mean I don't find church in my own ways, but why do you stay in church?
It's a good question. I mean, you know, in some ways, I don't even know how to quit it at this point. You know, it's just become kind of part of who I am. On the other hand, if I lived in certain places, I probably wouldn't go to church. I'm really lucky that I'm a part of a church community here that is a really beautiful presence in my life. I know a lot of people. In fact, there are people who join us online and they come to visit us when we do our like digital church weekends at church here. And they come and they go, I live in rural South Carolina, or I live in middle of nowhere in Idaho. And if I were not, quote unquote, going to church with you digitally, I wouldn't go to church anywhere because there isn't an alternative. It used to be that you kind of thought, well, if you broadcast church, then you're taking people away from a physical church. But in the moment that we're in, churches that are accepting of people, all people as they are, can be a little few and far between, depending on where you live. They sort of have faded away because people want their churches to look like their lives. They want them to be as partisan as they are. They want them to be as divisive as they are. And so there are churches that have really, they're thriving in this moment because they're willing to conform to the image of this world. Other churches that are more inclusive, that welcome our faith and our doubts, that welcome us no matter how we identify or what color our skin is or which bathroom we walk into, those churches often struggle in part because people grew up with those soundtracks. And so people who are most welcome in those churches have given up on church a long time ago. And that to me is really sad. But I also feel really grateful that there are many churches that I can name that are like Good Shepherd here in New York. I think that's why I stay, because I experience it as beautiful. You know, there's this sort of misconception that in order to become who you are, you have to like go off and do your work by yourself. And a lot of the work that we do is by ourselves. You know, contemplation can be very powerful. Solitude can be very powerful. Working with my spiritual director or my therapist is very, very powerful. And also, the process of becoming as human beings is a communal process. We do it together. I come to understand who I am in relationship with other people. You know, so like the idea that like, oh, I can't be in a relationship right now because I need to go like find out who I am, as if that happens apart from other people. For me, church is one of those places where a particular kind of community that is powerfully transformative can happen. Unfortunately, people take that good gift and they turn it into something really toxic. And so then you have to opt out. But what I hope for the church is that there will be more of these expressions of church that continue to kind of pop up around the country. And if they don't, that these digital expressions of those churches will be beamed out so that people who want those that don't have access to a physical one can find it in digital form.
And I do think there's a wave that's been coming, right? And I think what it takes is almost, like, I know I needed this when I was going through like deconstruction, reconstruction, was almost permission to think of things differently. And I think this book, your book, gives people that permission. Like, oh, you can go to church and you can be a person of God, no matter what your sexuality, gender, status, whatever, anything is. And so it's like these little seeds that are being planted are starting to become a forest, right? And so it's just maybe not as quick as some of us wanted to, but I do feel these little seedlings of hope that are being planted that hopefully by the time my kids are adults have places that it's not a question of, can I find a safe space? It's just, which safe place do I go to?
That's right. And I think there is no future for the church unless the future looks something like that. There's no future where the church continues to divide and sow hatred and to mirror the us versus them thinking and to engage in the scapegoating of the other and all of these things that are so counter to the gospel. I don't think that kind of church in the end works. I don't think it thrives because you can get that on Fox News without going to church, right? There are places that do bigotry better than the church ever will because they don't have to they don't have to maneuver around the actual gospel to do it. They can just get rid of all of that and just have that pure and simple bigotry. Religion, I think, supercharges bigotry. And so in some ways it's more insidious. But, you know, we saw this in the civil rights movement. You would see that you could take the same message on the same issues and you could go either direction. You could bend it and twist the gospel into this tool of hatred, or you could unleash the gospel to be an instrument of justice and equality. And so when we're confronted with the gospel in a church community, we have a choice. And not everybody chooses that right path. You know, isn't that what the Bible itself says? Oftentimes, people don't choose that path. They choose the other way. It's a very narrow path, and few choose it. So if you have an expression of Christianity that is dominant, it might be that that's the wide path. And I think we're seeing that with sort of the resurgence of fundamentalism.
Yeah, it gets scary when you have these underlying bigotry and racist and just all, you know, and then you put Jesus behind it and you feel like God's on your side, right? And it just becomes this infusion of like, I'm right. And I mean, progressives do it too, I guess, in a lot of regards too. Just the amount of harm that can be caused with that kind of thinking is scary. Yeah, it's scary.
Just curious, I mean, you do a lot of interviews, you talk to a lot of different people. What's something that what's a question no one's asked you that you would love to talk about, or a topic that no one gets into, perhaps with this book, with your other, you know, just the fact that you write about faith and culture?
My gosh, you know, most people tend to ask me big questions, like capital Q questions. So it's like, hey, you watch the culture, or you're sort of in tune with what's going on in the church. Like, what do you think the future of this is, or the future of that is? So I get a lot of like those cultural questions, and I would say I get less or fewer personal questions. And so sometimes, rarely, I'll have these kind of tender conversations. Those to me can be especially meaningful. I was having a conversation recently and somebody asked me a question about my first relationship and what it taught me. You know, moving to New York, that was, I had my first relationship in my 30s. You know, most people have it in their teens or maybe their 20s. And so what was that like and how did that change me and how was that a mess? Digging into some of those personal things, that to me is interesting. But, you know, then that's balanced with the other thing, which is I know that there are people who are listening to this and they're living in the tensions that we're talking about. And it's nice for them to have a personal conversation with me, but what they really want is just some help, some clarity, a new perspective, something that can kind of shake things loose or help things make sense. And so I kind of balance those two things out. Sometimes it's the same question, but it's a good question that's asked over and over and over in different forums that really does begin to shift the conversation.
Interesting. It's a good question about a relationship.
The book comes out. Is there any other things you're working on? What's kind of next for projects or things you're working on?
Well, this was my big project for the year, which is sort of interesting. I'm working on a potential next book for adults. We'll see. We'll see what shape that takes. I'm thinking a lot about that. And what I'm really wondering is like, you know, there's so much noise today. And so like, what do people need from me? What unique gift do I have to offer the world? Is that coaching? Is it courses? Is it a book? Is it, what is that thing? And I know you guys probably, you think about that as well, because, you know, you've built this like robust community where you've got, you know, conversation, music, meditation, art. And so, you know, you're developing along these fault lines, content and artifacts that people can kind of interact with and tools and resources. And so I think I'm always asking that question, like, which is what a lot of writers do, is they just create because they need the paycheck or because it's the next thing. And so I feel like, you know, just like this book kind of came to me, I'm going, okay, God, what is that next thing? Give me the download. Give me the thing. Give me the vision. And what I keep hearing is, right now, just get this baby out into the world, right? Just keep pushing. It's almost like the temptation is to name your second child while you're in labor with your first child. You're like thinking of the next one. And so what I want to do, I think, in this season is to be really present to the labor pains of this weird thing that I created, but it's so beautiful. And I think can be so hopeful. Get that out into the world and then trust that when that is out in the world, that next thing will show itself to me. And I'll go, oh yes, that's what it is.
It is kind of like, it's every time I did a sermon, right? It's like birthing a baby and then you need recovery time. You get paternity leave, you get a little break before you have to do the process over again. Enjoy the moments. Yeah.
And that's exactly right. And because it takes so long to make a book, you know, I mean, this book is like 24 months in the making. You know, you've got a lot of time. So by the time you get it out, it's like, okay, let's go. Time for the next. Because if I start working on a book right now, you know, you won't hear of it for 18 months. There is this pressure to become like, you know, content factories. And I feel that pressure. I feel that pressure in part in the same way that you probably feel this pressure, because we believe the world needs the content we have and the message we have. And there are so many other people who are content factories who are putting out the opposite of what we're putting out. And it's not good for the world. And it's fomenting more division and more hatred and more bigotry and more exclusivism and more confusion. And it's driving more people away from the faith. And from the Christian faith, I'm thinking a lot about that, realizing I don't have to save the world, but that my content is needed and that I can wait for it to show itself to me. And that's okay too. And I feel like that's the moment that I'm in as I'm kind of pushing this book out into the world.
Yeah, I'll digress here for a moment in the sense, like, what you're speaking right now resonates with, I'm going to speak for Chelsea and Dane, like, so much with us right now. We are going through a significant unearthing of our own. And so what you're saying, just thank you for putting that out there.
Yeah, my pleasure. And you know, the internet is always hungry. It's like, feed me. And everything is so like fleeting and ephemeral, you know, like you produce something and it's like, okay, that's old. It's been here for a month. Like, it's old. Let's move on, next. And so there is a temptation to live in that rhythm, that unsustainable rhythm of that hungry monster internet. And I have done it and it has burned me out. And so then how do you live in a more sustainable rhythm, right? Rather than feeding this thing when it's hungry, to simply serving the thing when it's ready.
I literally just getting Little Shop of Horrors. Feed me, Seymour, feed me.
Exactly.
Well, Jonathan, thank you for not only your time today and the conversations and thoughts you've shared, but for this beautiful book that is going to touch so many lives of children and parents and plant those little seeds of hope all throughout. The kids get to, you know, just having my own kids, reinforcing the message of acceptance and love and being who you are and taking those little treasure gifts of difference and letting them be seen by other people. It really is a gift. And like we were talking about, so needed, especially right now. Thank you so much.
Oh my gosh, thank you.
And just before we sign off, we just want to make sure people know how to connect to you. So where can they find you?
I'm really active on Instagram. That's my social media platform of choice. So Jonathan Merritt. And you can go to my website, jonathanmerritt.com. I have a newsletter there that you can sign up for that's about to maybe evolve into something more robust. They can sign up for my newsletter at jonathanmerritt.com as well.